when Hungary acceded to the presidency of the European Union, on the basis of which he was furiously attacked. And I believe it is said that he was threatened too. And so he said he would not return. He would not return to live there. So essentially, he is regarding himself, I imagine, as an exile, and a feeling for exile. I mean, it arrives to different people in different ways, I guess. To somebody like Schiff, it would have arrived painfully and suddenly, and as a violent intrusion, I think, into his life. And I think some of that may be available in a performance.
You yourself left Hungary when you were still a child. Do you feel as though you're an emigre?
It becomes more complicated as you get older, funnily enough. When I was a kid, I didn't think so at all. I just thought it was an English kid going to an English school. Albeit people said, you have a funny accent, and I still have an accent, maybe less funny. But yeah, you work your way into a sort of society. There's a history of Hungarian assimilation. One of the things you will not find in England is a Hungarian ghetto or a Hungarian area of London, for example. So there is this will and desire to assimilate. There are all kinds of possible reasons for it, including language. But as time goes on, not so much for me, but I think I notice it particularly in my parents and particularly in my mother, who as time went on was culturally cast adrift, which also means that you're psychologically to some degree cast adrift. Well, I'm a writer, I write in English, not in Hungarian, and so I have the comforts and the scope to be able to, if you like, to give voice to such things insofar as they appear, whereas to somebody of her generation with her lately learned English, I think that was much more difficult.
Is there something for an artist that determines which direction they take? As an emigre, is it easier somehow to use words or to use music to express your feelings of loss?
There's a lot of interesting things said about this. And it's true, you take people like Nabokov, you know, great writer writing in his second language. There's a sense in which you could argue, and it's very hard to argue in one's own case, because you're inside yourself and you don't know, that the language which then you take on has a kind of exotica, an exotic flavor to it, and that it is precious and odd, and that that may in some respects be an advantage, that is when it's not being a disadvantage. So, but it means that phrases just strike you with a certain precision and clarity because they do seem new. It's not something which you've kind of lived with from the very, very beginning.
I suppose, Malcolm, it's possible to think of Bartók as being an outsider right from the beginning. He was quite sickly as a child, wasn't he, and was kept apart from other people. Did that affect the way he grew up and his whole character?
I'm sure it did, and it left him very dependent upon his mother because his father died when Bartók was very young, age 5 or 6. But as well as that, you've got someone training to be a musician in a series of country towns, knowing from an early age that he had a special musical talent. And as his mother moved from town to town seeking work as a teacher, and that was difficult in the 1890s, I think Bartók was quite dislocated. And so by having gone to 5 or 6 different schools, he did find it harder to make friends, but then became very self-contained, very, very tough. He had some further illnesses when he was in his late teens and had to have a term off at the Liszt Academy, as it then became. And I think that further caused him to draw on inner resource and become absolutely determined to succeed.
Are we still slightly frightened of Bartók? Is that one of the problems? We're familiar maybe with the string quartets, which are a bit spiky and we're not quite sure about them. And then we're so surprised when we hear the later works.
Well, if I could modestly suggest something there. I think we're now going through a big change in Bartók reception because those who knew Bartók have essentially died. We've lost the connection directly with those who knew him well or were performing associates. So we now just have to get on by ourselves. And what we're doing in rediscovering Bartok's music now, having severed that direct link, I mean, Jörg Scholte was one of the last people who had one of those strong links there, or Jörg Sándor, you're in the position of saying, well, what does it sound like? And people suddenly think, well, you know, compared with what else has been written in the last 80 or 100 years, it's not so bad at all. In fact, maybe we are the ones who are mad, and maybe Bartok was always sane.
Well, that sounds like a good place to end. So it just remains for me to thank my two guests, George Surtees and Malcolm Gillis, and thank you two very much for coming.
Louise Fryer at the Royal College of Music. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley. The second half of this prom being given by the Halle Orchestra with its music director, Mark Elder. And as every concert in the season is, live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. The Halle ends with one of the great pieces of orchestral exhilaration, Janáček's Portrait of Liberty, his Sinfonietta. But during the interval, the Albert Hall stage has acquired a piano, the reason for that being Bartók's third piano concerto played tonight by András Schiff.
I know very well Bartók's piano playing. Luckily, he left a lot of recordings, and he was a magnificent pianist. And those recordings are invaluable because, to me, it's not just the best way to play Bartók, but the only way. Musical notation, as we see it on the printed score, it's very beautiful, but it's not a perfect way. There is no better way. But luckily, we know how Bartók played, and there is a rhetoric, a speaking element in the way he plays, and I want to convey that. I think we know very well what he wanted.
Well, Bartók fled from the fascist-oriented Hungary, spent the last 5 years of his life in the United States, where he struggled to make an impression. His health was fragile, money was scarce, and he pined for home. He was diagnosed with leukemia in the summer of 1945. The terminally ill composer wrote his third piano concerto for his wife, Ditta, to try to give her something that would guarantee her concert bookings after his death. Lynn Fletcher makes her way over to the piano, leader of the Halle. Tentative A, I'd say. Well, the music is mellower in this concerto than in the two earlier piano concertos. Two more brilliant movements, you could say, enclosing a calm, soothing, slow central one. Bartók marked it Adagio Religioso. The music seems to refer to the Hymn of Thanks in Beethoven's A minor string quartet, which he wrote when he recovered from illness. Bartók, too, went briefly into remission at this time, was grateful he could work again. The Beethoven Allusions, followed by one of Bartók's most evocative pieces of night music with birds whose songs he'd notated in North Carolina. And then Bartók invokes Bach, the other authority in his aesthetic world. The finale begins with a reference to Bartók's twin inspiration besides nature, folk music, pounding dance rhythms with their stress on the first note, reflecting the way Hungarian always stresses the first syllable of a word. But the piano writing throughout is less percussive and driven than in the two earlier piano concertos, surely because for the only time in his life, Bartók wasn't writing piano music for himself to play. And now here comes András Schiff, followed by Mark Elder, joining the Halle Orchestra to perform Bartók's third piano concerto.
Thank you.
The dance of life still dominant in Bartók's music, even if the composer himself was dying. His last just about completed work, the third piano concerto, played here in the Royal Albert Hall by Andras Schiff with the Halle Orchestra, conducted by Mark Elder. Very, really contained figure at the piano, Andras Schiff. Great shock of white hair. Flamboyant occasionally at the end of a passage, but actually very contained, and very light touch, which is exactly what Bartók himself had. If you heard Andras talking beforehand about how Bartók played, even if this concerto was written for Bartók's wife to play after his death. Mark Elder and Andras Schiff back on the platform. Mark Elder allowing Andras Schiff to take the whole limelight. Schiff's Tommy, he stayed in a cottage in the woods of Vermont, and he woke up to exactly the same birds that Bartók notates in the slow movement of that concerto. And he does say that he feels the slow movement is a metamorphosis, a renunciation by Bartók when close to death of that atheism that he'd said was absolutely firm right the way through from his teenage years. Bartók wrote the concerto away from the hated city. In this case, it was New York, on the shores of Lake Saranac. Hated cities because he felt cut off from nature. And he said that nighttime on the great Hungarian plain with the sounds of birds and insects inspired in him something close to religious feeling. Back onto the platform comes Andras Schiff. Just as focused, just as listenable too in Bartók piano concertos as he is, say, when he's accompanying Lieder. Had the good fortune to hear him accompanying Angelika Kirchschlager recently. Extraordinary musicianship this man has. Well, as I said, all three Bartók concertos this season. Jean-F. Lambabuse plays the first on next Tuesday, the 26th of July, London Philharmonic and Vladimir Yurovsky. All Hungarian programme, Kodály's Dances of Galanta, Liszt Faust Symphony, and some more. András Schiff's encore, a little magical slip of a piece, the Hungarian melody in B minor of Schubert, based on a folk song he heard when he was teaching the two daughters of Count Esterházy one summer in Hungary. That comes András Schiff running onto the stage. That's a bit of a holiday now before he goes off to play at the Salzburg Festival. Deep low bow to a very appreciative audience here in the Royal Albert Hall, and bowing in thanks to the Halle. Well, the piano will be moved away now, so the stage here in the Royal Albert Hall can accommodate quite a few more musicians, particularly brass players, and especially the 12 trumpets Janáček asks for in his Sinfonietta, his last symphonic work. Well, at rehearsal earlier, I asked Mark Elder what relationship he saw between the music of Bartók and Janáček.
Both Bartók and Janáček spent an enormous amount of time trying to find a way to reflect the inflections of their languages, and how the folk music in their great countries could inform a musical language. Their two countries, Moravia and Hungary. And they solved the problems in very different ways. But there is, as a result, an earthiness in their music that I enjoy so very much and is so valuable. There's something so grounded in these composers.
Can you describe the way Janáček uses the orchestra? I mean, it's very personal. It's kind of unidiomatic, at least when it comes to string writing.
He had a voice inside him all his life that was gritty, that was rhythmically very propelled, that had little folk song cells, often, as the basis of his music. This applies as much to his theatrical music as to his non-theatrical. And he liked writing in strange keys. A-flat minor was unquestionably his favourite key. No one else's, be it said. And the writing uses the extremes of the instrument's range and the sonorities of his music, so daunting when one first hears them, are so imaginative, original and thrilling to me. The sound of those snarling trombones at the beginning of the second movement, the sound in the third movement of the piccolos and flutes, screaming in terror, as we are asked to remember what the Queen's Monastery was used for, not for spiritual contemplation, which of course is what he remembered it as being, because he sang there as a boy, I think, in the choir, didn't he?
Mark Elder. Well, the Sinfonietta is a remarkable example of the immense creative energy that filled Janáček at the end of his career. Success had come late to him. He was in his early 60s before his opera Jenufa was a huge success in Vienna during the First World War. 2 years later, his artistic liberation from obscurity was joined by a feeling of personal liberation with the end of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. He felt that his home city of Brno was transformed in front of his eyes. For instance, the hated Spielberg Castle, which had a notorious dungeon where the Habsburgs held political prisoners, lost its aura of terror as a prison. One sunny summer's day, 7 years after the birth of the new free Czechoslovakia, the 72-year-old composer was sitting in a park with the young Kamila Sturzlova, his muse for the last decade of his life. They were listening to a military band concert. Janáček was much taken with some fanfares they played and incorporated them soon afterwards into his Sinfonietta. He explained how the music of the piece described his feelings about Brno after his country won independence. I saw the town undergo a miraculous change. I lost my aversion for the gloomy town hall, my hatred for the hill from whose depths so much pain was screaming, my distaste for the street and what was crawling in it. As if by a miracle, the sheen of liberty spread, shining over the town. I belong to this resurrection, and the blare of the victorious trumpets, the shadows of night, the breath of the green hill, and the vision of the growing greatness of the town of my Brno were all giving birth to my Sinfonietta. The musicians to play that Sinfonietta are now all safely ensconced on the stage, with right at the back, high up on the platform, the trumpets, the extra trumpets, two bass trumpets, two tenor tubas, right high up, right next to the bust of Sir Henry Wood, and just in the lee under the organ. And
normal brass section on the other side of the stage. Mark Elder rehearsed this very thoroughly early today, and here he is back on the platform to conduct the Halle in Janáček's Sinfonietta.
Thank you.
Janáček's Sinfonietta, which he said expressed the contemporary free man, his spiritual beauty and joy, his strength, courage and determination to fight for victory. It's been performed here at the Royal Albert Hall to end tonight's prom live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, by the Halle Orchestra, led by Lynn Fletcher, conducted by its music director, Sir Mark Elder. Conducting baton list tonight, real fluidity. That was his word, not mine. He thinks that that's what it brings him. Decide sometimes to conduct with a baton, sometimes without. Tonight, it was without. Even with all those trumpets, tenor tubas, bass trumpets, all standing up, like by the bust of Sir Henry, for the opening and closing of that piece. Originally intended those fanfares for a gymnastic festival, quite heavily scored for such a graceful event. And the orchestral brass, not the extras, being brought to their feet by Mark Elder. And the wind. Next year, this lot will be playing their first Beethoven cycle for many years. Chronologically during the season, Elder, Van Steen, Edward Gardner, the violinist Nikolai Snyder conducting the Ninth Symphony. That should be fascinating. And that big cheer, that's for the nine trumpets, the two bass trumpets and the two tenor tubas. Wonder how many of them will be playing in the pit, because the Halle Orchestra finally going into the pit at the Lowry Theatre in Manchester to perform Bernstein's Wonderful Town, which Mark himself will be conducting. He's off to the Far East, South Korea and China, and Tannhäuser at the Paris Bastille in October. If you want to listen to this concert again, or you missed some of it, you can catch it again for a week, of course, or indeed this coming Sunday afternoon at 2 PM here on Radio 3. Tomorrow evening's BBC Prom, well, that gives you the chance to compare and contrast the Halle with Manchester's other orchestra, the BBC Philharmonic, as its chief conductor designate, Juanjo Mena, makes his Prom's debut. Mena, born in the Basque Country, his programme hovers deliciously between France and Spain. He produces images interspersed with evocations of Spain, Ravel and De Falla, his Nights in the Gardens of Spain, the piano soloist Stephen Osborne. Well, those are tomorrow's Prom's delights, live here on Radio 3. But as Mark Elder returns to the stage, brings the Halle to its feet, time for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, thank you very much. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And as Martin was saying, there's another chance to hear this evening's first Prom this Sunday at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Well, back to this evening, and in 10 minutes or so tonight, our feature, Myths and Mystery Cycles, John Sessions, explores a research project rewriting the story of early English drama. That's at 10 o'clock. Until then, staying with Janáček, this is one of his male voice choruses, not perhaps of a familiar sight to him outside Czech lands. We heard a couple of them after the Janáček Glagolitic Mass in the first night of the Proms. This chorus tells the sad tale of Marička Magdonova, the orphaned daughter of a miner, her father murdered by comrades and her mother crushed by a coal wagon. Marička's left to look after her younger brothers and sisters, but is caught by the police while out gathering wood on the estate of a German landlord. And rather than face the shame of a public trial, she throws herself into the river Ostrovice, the word Ostrovice, much repeated towards the end of the song. The singers at the premiere in 1908 were the self-same choir, same in name anyway, as sing on this 1970 recording of it, the Moravian Teachers Choir. Music by Janáček, his male voice chorus, Marička Magdanova. Its alternating double and quintuple rhythms, generating a very free declamatory manner whose flow seems to express perfectly the narration of a very beautiful and very tragic song. And its challenges holding no terrors for the performers there. The Moravian Teachers Choir, conducted by Antonín Tuchapský, a recording from 1970, that particular song, Janáček, dedicated to the Moravian Teachers Choir, so perhaps it shouldn't be surprising the authenticity of both style and feeling is as strong as it is.
From the BBC Proms, principal conductor Sir Roger Norrington bids farewell to the Stuttgart Radio Symphony Orchestra, and a post he's held since 1998. On BBC Radio 3, live from the Royal Albert Hall, you can hear one of Norrington's final performances with his orchestra, and one of the greatest of all late Romantic symphonies, Mahler's Symphony No. 9, live from the BBC Proms, Monday night at 7:30.
This is BBC Radio 3, it's 10 o'clock, and now on Radio 3, the actor John Sessions turns medieval archivist as he discovers the scale and detail of a research project that's redefining the story of our theatrical heritage. He begins his exploration of the myths and mysteries of our dramatic past alongside Professor David Klausner in the distinctly untheatrical setting of the Borthwick Library at the University of York, pawing over a dusty ledger. Myths and Mystery Cycles.
Rydale.
Yes, this is in the rural deanery of Rydale. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 entries here. The top one here says William Ure. They are accused that they have given monthly sermons in his default, being proprietary of the rectory there. And also, the choir door and windows want repair. This is probably church wardens who are being accused of not keeping the fabric of the church in good
repair. You're eavesdropping on a medieval scholar in full enthusiastic flow. Professor David Klausner is a Reed editor. Reed, standing for Records of Early English Drama. Now, bishops nagging church wardens over the upkeep of their choir doors may not seem the most auspicious place to start an exploration of the origins of the drama that matured and thrived in the reigns of Queen Elizabeth and King James I. But it's through the minute exploration of documents like this, and court records, council minutes, even, heaven forfend, account books, that we're learning an astonishing amount about the true nature of the artistic society in which Shakespeare flourished.
Coventry, 1573. Charges of the pageant. Paid to God, 3 shillings and 4 pence. Paid to the prologue, 8 pence. Paid 3 saved souls, 5 shillings. Paid for shutting the door, dressing the pageant and keeping the wind, 16 pence.
The books and papers the Reed editors examine don't include the few surviving play manuscripts that have dominated thinking on this subject for years. The so-called mystery cycles of York, Chester, and the one which now appears to be wrongly attributed to Wakefield, are hugely important. But they've misled us into a top-down view of the way English drama developed. Instead, the Reed army, and it is an army, is looking for any reference, any clue, that sheds light on the work and working lives of musicians, performers and players. The research is being conducted county by county and occasionally, as in the cases of York, Cambridge or Newcastle, city by city. Just how it's progressing, and has been for over 30 years, what impact the work has had on the study of our dramatic past, and why that should matter far beyond the cloistered world of medieval history and literature, is the theme and purpose of this programme. But it all begins here, in the archives. We're looking at the Visitation Court Book of 1615. David, can you tell me what this actually was?
The Archbishop of York, as all other bishops, did a regular visitation around the diocese, stopping in the various deaneries, essentially checking up on the morals of the inhabitants. This is the parish of Kirkdale, you can see up here, in Rydale.
Rydale, yeah.
Yes. The very first one here I ignored completely because it's got two names in it, Thomas and Miriam, and then you can see the Latin word fornicat with an abbreviation mark after it. Well, we know what that's all about. And
right.
That's of no interest to Reed whatever.
No, because Reed is a very virtuous
organization. Reed is, yeah, it is indeed. So we have absolutely no interest in village matters, as Hamlet would say.
Yes.
So,
rumpy pumpies.
Rumpy pumpies.
The Scots would say, yes.
Yes. The first process, of course, is going through the documents themselves, as that's what we've been doing here, and actually tracking down references that are important, that have something to do with, and the Reed mantra is drama, minstrelsy, and mimetic ceremony. The difficulty with it is if you ask, what does a Reed editor need to do in a particular locale, in the North Riding or in Wales or something like that? The real answer is you need to read all of the surviving documents prior to 1642. That's a warehouse full.
It's rather like, I don't know, prospecting for
zirconium. Oh, it is. No, that's exactly what it is.
You clearly are a very patient man.
John, you have to be. This volume is a rather good example. There are about 375 folios, so that translates to 750 pages in this volume.
So this would take you how long to work through?
I can do it in a day.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
You have to, though, and you have to start reading a volume like this knowing full well that it is entirely possible that you may read 750 pages and take a whole day or more over it, and you will not find a thing.
These documents are records of desire. The desires of the people who were involved in the plays, the desires of the sponsors, of those who funded them. And so you are getting directly rooted into the culture and the feelings of the time, even although you're dealing with dusty documents.
I think it's amazing that somebody took on a project to try to put together a map, and it really is a map, of the whole of arts activity in Britain across an enormous period of time up to 1642, to sustain that so far over 20-something volumes with 20-odd more to come, that is an astonishing scholarly achievement.
The situation 50 years ago, 60 years ago, was really as if we had the rules for rugby and a film of some people playing football, and the temptation would be to assume that they were playing by the same rules, and you would come to conclusions which are wholly irrelevant about who was winning and who was losing and what the hell they were doing. If, like me, you think context is absolutely vital for the meaning of a play at any moment, particularly at the royal court or in a noble household, then the Reed records are invaluable.
I can't account for why I'm still doing it, you know? It's endlessly fascinating. There are so many variations that it's constantly stimulating and challenging. But the biggest challenge for me now is to figure out how we can move this all online. And that's what I see as a really important purpose that we have.
The Canadian voice of Sally Beth McLean, the executive editor of Reed. I say Canadian because we should make it clear early on that this is a project centred upon, inspired and to a large extent funded by the University of Toronto. Before her, you heard the voices of Professor Peter Holland, Professor Greg Walker and another of the Reed editors, Professor John McGavin, who's gathering material from dusty Scottish documents, taking the project's ambition well beyond its original English boundaries. The key to this daunting enterprise is the vigilance of focus. Much of the reading of crudely written Middle English or Latin or even Welsh texts has to be discarded. The precious residue goes into the red volumes that make up the Reed collection.
Hereford, 1620. Acts of the Decanal Court. Proceedings of the court held in the Dean's Consistory of Hereford Cathedral before Master Jones. Anthony Wheeler, cleric, vicar there, was a spectator of such as danced before evening prayer on Sabbath days, that is, on 27th of August last. John Powell, for being the fiddler thereat.
I absolve you, John Powell, from the sour condemnation of your joyless puritanical judges. And that's the compelling thing about these records. Where you might anticipate pages of snore-inducing anonymous detail, real people emerge. And that creates another challenge for the editor. Who and how much should they include? Sally Beth McLean.
It is a constant debate. Just to go back to the very earliest days, there was certainly some pretty strong arguments in favor of including liturgical processions, because Corpus Christi plays, as they were then called, were part of the processions outside the church. But we made a very definite decision that we were not going to be real, the records of early English liturgy. We were going to define the territory as secular drama, entertainment, mimetic entertainment in particular.
But with no religious mimetic overtones or undertones?
There are obviously religious undertones to the biblical play productions and some of the early saints' plays, for instance, yes. But liturgy itself in the churches, we do not get into.
No.
And we don't include liturgical music.
Those decisions were crucial in ensuring that this would not be a process of adding further detail to our understanding of the highest echelons of religious and court society. Less bird and talus, more pipe and tabor, you might say. I was speaking to Sally Beth McLean at the annual Medieval Congress in Leeds, a rendezvous for people involved in and supporting the Reed Project. Professor Pamela King of Bristol University explained to me the history of the resurgent interest in early English drama.
There were antiquarians working out in the counties and in London who were aware of these records. But because nobody performed the plays, and the plays were thought to be scurrilous and blasphemous in all sorts of ways, it was difficult for them to understand what the records referred to in any meaningful way. It was also very difficult for them to have anybody pay attention to them. The London intellectual establishment simply dismissed their efforts, and it took a particular moment in the revival of interest in the plays, and particularly the revival in interest in the plays as heritage. Festival of Britain is possibly the great marker of that, to create an environment where people were reading them and wanted to know more about the context from which they came.
2 years after the 1951 Festival of Britain, the BBC made their contribution.
The BBC presents The First Stage, a chronicle of the development of English drama from the 10th to the 14th century. Arranged for broadcasting by John Barton and produced by Raymond Rakes.
We've already taken the story to the beginning of the 13th century, at which point English drama was beginning to be English and tending to become dramatic.
Along with the gentle wisdom of John Barton were the exuberant reworked versions of the medieval texts that remained from Chester or York or Coventry. Noah is brought to life here by none other than John Laurie, no doubt anticipating that mankind was doomed.
Have done, you men and women all. Hie you, lest the water fall, to work this ship, chamber and hall, as God hath bidden us do. Shem, my son.
Yea, father, I'm ready full soon. An axe have I by my crown, as sharp as any in all this town, for to go thereto. And here comes Brother Ham.
This labour is full great for an old man such as me. Lo, lo, how fast I sweat. It trickles about my ear. To home now will I wend, my weary bones for to rest. For such good as God hath sent, there get I of the best. To home now will I wend, I wend, to home now will I...
Dramatisations like this, full of earthy verve, albeit curtailed by 1950s primness, and books like E.M. W. Tillyard's The Elizabethan World Picture, were still touchstones when I was at university. The received view of our dramatic history was an evolutionary one. Liturgical dramas were born out of a desire to bridge the gap between churchmen and the non-Latin-speaking congregation. From thence they evolved, outgrew their church confines, and became miracle plays and mystery cycles, and it wasn't long before wandering players and minstrels, things of shreds and patches, started the journey that would lead to the theatres of London's South Bank. Hopelessly oversimplified, I know, but it serves to set the context in which the Reed Project was incubated.
I'm Alexandra Johnston, Professor Emeritus at the University of Toronto and founder and director of Records of Early English Drama.
Professor Johnston, known in Reed circles as Sandy, invited me to the museum in York, where the document that inspired the entire project is on temporary display.
I was working on my first sabbatical in the Library of York Minster. I was sitting at the table in the Minster Library one day when the then librarian, Bernard Barr, pitched a letter across the table to me, and I looked at it, and it was a transcription of the inventory of the Mercers, or Merchant Adventurers, of their pageant of judgment in the York Cycle. It's the only complete description of a pageant wagon in England that exists. It was a spectacular discovery.
This is the catalyst for the whole Reed enterprise. Can you talk us through what is going on in the document?
Okay, first of all, it's an indenture. You can see how it's cut at the top. The reason why they did that was there was two halves of the document. One half was kept by the company, one half was kept by the pageant masters. And it starts off by saying it's an indenture made in the Feast of Corpus Christi in the year of our Lord God, 1433. And then it describes, first of all, the pageant. They say pageant with four wheels, hellmouth. And then go into the costumes. Three garments for three devils and six devils' faces.
Three vezins or masks, array for two evil souls, that is to say two cirques or shirts, two pair of hose, two masks and two wigs, array for two good souls, two pairs of angel wings with iron in the end.
Iron in the end. And one of the neat things is that later we find the Mercers are renting angel wings from the Barkers, who did the first day of creation. Obviously, their wings were not particularly good.
This is no exquisite artifact. It's a working document, tightly written, discoloured, slightly frayed, and it had been hidden away in a solicitor's vault. It turned out that Professor Johnston wasn't alone in her discovery. Another scholar, Margaret Rogerson, was also homing in on the document that was to change both their lives. And from the very start, collaboration was the watchword.
I asked for her address and invited her to dinner, and in our youthful enthusiasm, decided we would do all the records of York and publish them together. And that's the document.
And this wasn't a mystery play as such, was it?
Well, it was part of the York cycle.
Right.
So it was a mystery play in that rather loose and now outmoded terminology. It was one of the biblical cycle performed in York, and this was the last judgment. This was the finale.
And why do you say outmoded?
Mystère comes from the French word for craft guild. That was used by scholars in the early 20th century. We no longer use that term because it's misleading. They were more than the possession of the craft, they were the possession of the city, they were probably written by clerics. We know a great deal more about them than the folk in the late 19th century who named them mystery plays.
How excited were you when you came across this?
Boy, they had to scrape me off the ceiling. Within the academic world, the buzz was huge. Margaret and I were invited to present that document at the Modern Language Association in New York the next Christmas. And then the Christmas after that, at the same conference, this time in Chicago, everybody said, we've got to have a big project to do this. And as I flew across frozen Lake Michigan on the way home from that conference, I conceived the idea of Reed, and 2 years later it happened.
What makes Sandy Johnston such a beguiling crusader, in a field which always runs the risk of being rather dry and distant, is her eye for the demotic, the details in the documents that speak of ordinary people at work.
You see those fold lines? That means that the pageant masters kept them folded up, and I like to think the pageant masters had it in their belt because you can see how the ink has rubbed where it's been folded.
Abraded, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That guided the performance until they rebuilt the wagon in 1522.
As I was in York, I didn't want to miss an opportunity to see the Minster, which I've never seen. So here I am, looking up at the east window, well, the facsimile of the east window. You just see this bustling world, and it shouldn't surprise us that all the county records, which Reed so sedulously worked their way through, reflect that.
Herefordshire, 1358. Household accounts of Queen Isabella, widow of Edward. For John Monsores, a harper, while performing his minstrelsy before the Lady Queen at Hereford by gift of the same, on 9th July, 6 shillings and 8 pence.
I can show you one that came up this morning. Here's a pair of prosecutions of two gentlemen, both named George, for, and you can actually read it there because this is a very nice hand, for playing the sheriff at a rush bearing. And then the next one, for playing Robin Hood at the said rush bearing.
Rush bearing, could you just gloss that,
sure,
please?
The rush bearing was a ceremony in which they would bring rushes into the church, put new rushes on the floor, decorate the walls of the church with rushes, so forth. In many cases, it was actually done as part of the church's patronal festival. So it would be on the feast day of the saint to whom the church has dedicated. Given that in this record the guy is playing the sheriff, this is already a Reed reference because he's doing something mimetic. He's creating a character. And the other one, the other George, who is playing Robin Hood, having actually spent about a week working on the North Riding, this is the first Robin Hood record I found. So I'm actually very pleased about this.
David Klausner. So Robin Hood plays, rush-bearing festivities, and plays telling the life of a parish patron saint were the norm, not a staple diet of mystery plays or cycles. That's the picture emerging from the fragments, confuting the evolutionary theory of English drama.
We know that Darwin has absolutely nothing to do with drama, and what we rather snidely call the evolutionary theory of English drama is a load of nonsense. There's all kinds of evidence for this. Liturgical drama, both within the liturgy and outside it, coexisted right through the whole of the Middle Ages. There was no kind of evolutionary development in which it left the liturgy because it got too big, or it left the church because it got too expensive. All of these things were actually taking place simultaneously.
What the Records of Early English Drama project has done is to provide a picture of a land where we have very few plays surviving, but one that was absolutely heaving with theatre, in which the York Cycle of Mystery Plays stands out as a remarkable oddity.
Pamela King again. My understanding of their argument is that the idea of the York or Chester cycles being typical would be like believing Wagner's Ring was typical of 19th century opera. The frustration for them will always be that they don't have the manuscripts for the equivalent of, let's say, Carmen or La Bohème. But this is why the Reed references that are being found are so valuable.
We know from those volumes of records from Kent that the villages around New Romney, on the marsh, all got together annually to put on a huge passion play. Here's another idiocy that I grew up with, which was that England had cycles of mystery plays, France had Passion. We had Passion. We got some lovely things about the New Romney passion play, including the fact that we know who wrote the record. And we know, for example, that the Torturers of Christ come straight out of what we would have called the morality play tradition. They were called Mischance, False at Need, Untrust, Faint Heart, Unhap, Evil Grace. And beside the note that says Faint Heart is a little note that says, by me, Simon Padiham. So we also know that a guy called Simon Padiham, who played Faint Heart, wrote the record. Now that's the sort of thing that I get excited by. We're not bound by those few manuscripts in the British Library and the Bodleian, which 19th century editors found and edited, which have become canonical.
Old-time theatre scholarship was really driven by people who read plays and wanted to know something about them.
Professor Peter Holland, an independent voice on the subject.
Reed does it back to front. They have all this evidence of performance, and we don't know, for the most part, what the plays were that were being performed. But what they tell us about these plays is very different kinds of things. They tell us often that there was a great press of people at a play, so great that an iron bar that kept the door shut got bent and the city had to pay to have it repaired, so the record survives. They tell us about the frequency with which companies turn up in cities and towns. They tell us about where the players played. Not in inn yards, but in guild halls, even in churches, often playing in private houses, and also about amateur performances, so that we've got this sense of a kind of different way in which drama is permeating the culture. All the time we're used to thinking of it being driven by plays, but in fact there are lots of other kinds of events, like rush bearing and maypole dancing, a lot of public events. And everybody is making their own performance out of the richness of the world that they find around them. That's why one of the things I love are these ways in which they produce little local topical dramas. There was a great attack on a local worthy who was called Constable Hole. And you can imagine exactly what happened to his surname. What they're doing is something that we might call Chaucerian, as if they have to have the imagination of Chaucer to do it. But in fact, this is the very stuff out of which Chaucer makes the great stories that make up the Canterbury Tales.
Wells, 1607. Interrogatories for principal defendants in Hole versus White et al. Did you, about said 18th of June, ride astride in a red petticoat kerchief and muffler or some woman's apparel about the streets in Wells, then holding a spinning wheel upon the horse before you and worsted wool upon a distaff, then turning the said wheel as you rode? Did you say as you so rode that it was Hole's wool, and then sang Hole, Hole, or words to that effect? And whose was the horse that you so rid upon? Speak the very truth upon your oath.
The case against Constable Hole's persecutor-in-chief, Edmund White, in 1607. This is the sort of material Reed executive editor Sally Beth MacLean hopes will enliven medieval and Elizabethan history for students and local historians once her website ambitions are realised, and it'll be freely available. But her greatest ambition is to rid the textbooks of the many myths about the medieval period and the drama and music that coloured it.
There's very little that's been found for in-yard performance, and that includes the Elizabethan era. People are taught to think that when the professional companies of London were forced onto the road with their pumps full of gravel, etc., that it was the plague that drove them out of the city, that normally they wouldn't choose to go to the provinces. But what we are finding, of course, is that they were going out to the provinces because they were welcomed by towns and gentry and nobility.
Yes, and
so they got bed and board when they went to the private residences. They had pretty nice indoor performance conditions there. And so what you have is a glimpse into what I think of as alternative theater, 21st century style. I mean, they had to be very adaptable to a wide variety of locations, but rather comfortable indoor locations, not out there in the beating sun or the pouring rain.
So very little evidence of let's do the play right here in the Inn Yard, although plenty of money being paid to players, performers and minstrels. And according to Elizabeth Baldwin, one of the editors for the Reed volume covering Chester, no simple across-the-board status for players and musicians.
You get at the top level the players who belong to livery companies and lords and the king's minstrels and things like that. But there's a certain downgrading, so you get the whole concept of the strolling minstrels. But at a parish level, they weren't actually strolling that far. And they were often men who had other professions as well, talking more about the musicians, who would be a tailor during the week, and then they go off and play the fiddle for parties on the weekend or on saints' days and things like that. You can say to students, look, there's someone here who was paid to play God or paid to set the world on fire.
Who was paid to set the world on fire?
It was Robert Crowe in Coventry, and he was capper, and he was writing or at least revising plays. He was also providing props. And in this particular play, which was Doomsday, he was paid to set the world on fire three times. So they evidently had a model of the world, and at the very end of Doomsday, up it went in smoke three times. One of the reasons we know that there were probably three performances of each pageant in Coventry in the 16th century.
And this is one of the really nice links between the records and the manuscript.
Pamela King again.
In the one surviving original manuscript of a Coventry pageant, Robert Crowe signs off at the end and says, this matter newly made by me, Robert Crowe, this day of March 1535. He's not a wonderful playwright, but he's a particular kind of theatrical person. And there are some lovely documents from the Leet, which was Coventry's city council from the same period, because it was a period of recession that these records survive from. Coventry, which famously made blue cloth, Coventry Blues, the football team, they couldn't get the alum to fix the woad, and so their single product economy went into decline. And some of the guilds were having difficulty sustaining their pageants. And the Leet wrote this long document, which is there in the Reed volume, that urges guilds to combine together, above all, to preserve the mystery plays for the unity and amity of the city.
The unity, concord and amity of all cities and commonalities. How refreshing is that as a summary of what drama can be? And there it is in a local government document of 1496. Is it too much to believe that their care for guild performances was rewarded by the Coventry Carol's survival to this day?
I'm going to have a go at reading this to see if I can read it.
Well, look at this second one. That's a good one to read, because that's something that we haven't seen before. So this is somebody by the name of John Beadle.
For not paying...
Yes.
For the something wage? Is that
wages?
Wages.
Yes. The clerk.
The clerk, yes, I see.
For not paying the clerk's... He's not paying his church tax.
Right.
A bit cheeky of me attempting to be a Reed editor for a day, but it was a quick way of discovering just how exacting the task is for David Klausner and his colleagues. And all this to be done when their teaching and other scholarship permit. Of course, for David and Elizabeth Baldwin, reading and locating the...